It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In December, Christine Mohammed was named Executive Director of the Pittsburgh Chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE Pittsburgh. It's the largest Muslim civil rights and advocacy organization in the nation, and she's the first woman to hold the post in the Pittsburgh chapter. Christine, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
For the unfamiliar, what is the mission of CARE on a national level?
On a national level, CARE's mission is to enhance the understanding of Islamic faith and what that entails, and to protect civil rights, promote justice, not just amongst the American Muslim community, but we work with other organizations to support their efforts as well. And just to be here to be able to empower the local American Muslim community.
Are there nuances to that mission at individual chapters, including Pittsburgh?
Yes, for Pittsburgh. So we are independent from national, though we do share, you know, proprietary information and things like that. They do a lot of workshops and other things as well. And so I have a network of other people on the same goal and mission. But Pittsburgh, we are able to then take it and tailor it so it reaches the narrative of our community and very specific to Pittsburgh, because Pittsburgh is unique in its own way. So.
In what ways are you trying to empower Muslims? You mentioned empower as one of the parts of the mission.
Yeah, so one of the ways that we like to empower American Muslims is to make them aware of their rights, their discrimination or things that may occur within the community. An instance, maybe a worker is having some trouble wearing their headscarf or maybe having prayer time, those types of accommodations. Not knowing your rights and not knowing what help and support is available to you, you may feel helpless. So we give them an opportunity. We'll have workshops and discussions to help them know their rights. So if they see something or hear something, they know that there's something that they can do and they're not alone.
Are these individuals, have they been in the country long? Are they native to this country? Or are they maybe Muslims who have moved here from another country and knowing their specific rights in this country and as Muslims as well?
I feel like, to be honest with you, it's a mixed bag, right? Because we do have a demographic in a community that is very diverse and people coming from various countries coming here to get their citizenship that have an Islamic faith.
Right.
But there are a lot of people converting also to the religion of Islam. I'm one myself. And we may not just being caught up in everyday life, not necessarily understand when you're in a new faith tradition, how that reflects to your constitutional rights as an American. Because when I first converted, you know, I was nervous to tell my employer that I wanted to start wearing my headscarf or that I needed to pray or that Ramadan was coming up if I could have a slightly different working schedule. Those were well within my rights to ask for that, but I felt a little shy. Mm-hmm. I felt like, oh, I can't do that. And so now being educated and knowing those rights, you know, it's important to us to empower other Muslims so they know those rights as well, so nobody gets discriminated in work or in personal life.
Christine, you previously taught a class at Carnegie Mellon University. It was called Lions, Tigers, and Muslims, Oh My, to help dispel misconceptions about Islam. What are some of those misconceptions?
I will say there are two things that consistently, from my perspective and my experience, that stands out would be women's rights or women in general in Islam, as well as Sharia law.
Give us some specifics involving Sharia law and some of the misconceptions.
So what it is you have the media spinning and showing aspects of Sharia law that are only about 5% of Sharia law deals with justice and punishment. So you have this great 95% of Sharia law that you never hear anything about. And it's basically a code of ethics and character of how a Muslim should live their daily life. It's something that they choose. It tells you what to eat, how to treat your neighbors, encourages charity, tells you how to pray. Mm-hmm. So it's a variety of that. And those things don't necessarily get covered. Usually what you see is something on the news that some woman was stoned or, you know, some man had his hand cut off without any education or understanding that whole concept of Sharia.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin talking to Christine Mohammed of CARE Pittsburgh. In many religions, men either dominate or exclusively hold leadership positions. you mentioned one of the misconceptions about Islam, that women are oppressed. How unusual is it for you as a woman to lead an Islamic organization?
CARE National actually has 27 chapters that have executive directors. 9 of them are women. So I feel like women in Islam and leadership roles is something that dates back even to the time of the Prophet, peace be upon him. We have stories of women like Nusayba who fought right beside him, and their input was appreciated and considered.
Have you experienced any pushback or resistance since you were appointed as the first woman executive director of CARE Pittsburgh?
As of yet, no. I have not received any pushback. I have had the most warmest welcome from National and a lot of the other chapters just reaching out and welcoming me. My own Islamic faith community, I attend the Islamic Center of Pittsburgh. They were very welcoming. I got many letters, a letter from the imam and the board, just basically congratulating me.
How do you think your journey to Islam, you mentioned earlier that you're a convert, will influence your leadership of the organization?
I think the fact that I am a convert and American gives me a little bit of a unique perspective. It is the reason that I am as passionate as I am about what I do. When I first converted to Islam, I did get pushback. I got pushback from everybody, including close family members. There was a lack of understanding and a fear for me because they loved me. And I did experience for the very first time what it's like to be discriminated against, what it's like to get stares, what it's like to have a woman pull her children closely to her as she's looking at you with fear in her eye. And I realized that I have a voice and my mother raised me well, and I need to go out there and do something about it. So I started teaching and started speaking and learning and doing the things that I could. And it led me to this opportunity. So I look forward to taking all the experiences that I've had on my own journey, the ups, the downs, the good, the bad, the ugly, and carry that into this position and to hopefully help empower other Muslims so they can go ahead and pick up that torch as well.
According to the FBI, in 2018, one of every 5 hate crimes against people of faith in the United States targeted Muslims. What is your assessment of the environment in Pittsburgh, the attitude toward Muslims in the region?
I feel like in the Pittsburgh region, the attitude is overall pretty friendly. I've gone to a number of panels and events where non-Muslims were invited and allowed to ask questions to Muslims, and they seemed very engaged, very curious. And curiosity is something that is a good thing, because without the curiosity, then people are making assumptions and consuming their own narrative, which then can lead to violence or acts of discrimination, even without knowing it. I have had instances in Pittsburgh that, you know, where I have been discriminated. I've had people call me names. I've had people rev their car engines at me as I'm crossing the street. But I don't like to see that as all of Pittsburgh. I was born and raised here. There are good people in this community. We just got to band together. And I truly, with my whole heart, believe that.
The national arm of your organization has been quick to condemn a recent stabbing attack at a Hanukkah celebration in New York. There have been other examples of outreach as well. They expressed solidarity with the Jewish community in Jersey City after a shooting, condemned racist incidents at a church in North Carolina, and locally, following the Tree of Life shooting in 2018, the Islamic community raised money for the funerals of the victims. Do you feel that you are receiving reciprocal support from other faith communities, other minorities, when Muslims are being attacked?
Absolutely. During the Tree of Life shooting, I personally received emails from friends saying, hey, if you're scared to go to your mosque, I'll come with you. Don't be scared. If you're scared to go out, I'll come with you. So I have had support from many other people in different organizations where people are taking the time to make sure that Muslims also feel secure and safe within this community.
What's your plan to improve relations, expand maybe on what's already in place with other faith communities in the Pittsburgh area?
I'm hoping to meet with a lot of the different organizations. CARE itself, we work very closely with a lot of organizations like the Union Project, PIN, the Thomas Merton Center, Deadly Exchange. We go to some of their events. They come to some of ours. We support. And so I want to expand that and keep growing it. I mean, we also work with Bend the Arc, Casa San Jose. So it's a nice, diverse group of people. And we're all just trying to get communication and understanding together out there. And so continuing to work with them and then expanding that invitation to any group out there that wants to sit down with us and talk. Let's come together. I am willing to come together.
Christine Muhammad is the new executive director of the Pittsburgh chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE Pittsburgh. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me. It means a lot to me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Special education advocates say the Commonwealth's share of the costs for special education has declined over the last decade, and they're calling on Governor Wolf to propose a big boost in funding in his upcoming budget plan. Sarah Schneider is WESA's education reporter, joins us in studio. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Kevin.
So just how much has the state's portion of this money declined?
Sure. So a recent study in October from the Education Law Center and Research for Action found that, you know, while costs have grown, costs for supports and services for students with disabilities by nearly 60% since 2008, funding from the state has only grown by 10%. So another way to say that is in 2008, the state was paying for a third of costs. And now in 2019, the state was paying for about a fourth of costs.
Mm. So in recent years, the amount the state is contributing, the raw number of dollars has actually gone up, I believe up more than $50 million in this current budget year, about $1.2 billion total. If the state is offering more, what's going on?
Yeah, so the cost of services really are just growing. So training for this type of one-on-one service is really expensive, and more students are being identified with disabilities. And so that could include, you know, speech therapy, occupational therapy, and it's just really expensive. And so advocates have a number of different reasons why those costs are growing, but really we just know it is much more than it was in 2008. And the amount of money that the state is paying toward those services has not kept up. It puts a lot of burden on local school districts.
Sorry. I believe you said the number of students is increasing. I believe it's around 300,000 in the
Correct.
State.
Yeah.
So the state changed how it distributed special ed dollars about 5 years ago. Do advocates think that that has helped at all?
Yeah. So the state created this funding formula similar in some ways to the way that the state distributes basic education funding, but it's separate. It's specifically looks at what a student needs in the classroom. And it's important to note that this only applies to what advocates call traditional public schools. It does not apply to charter schools, which is a concern that these advocates have raised too. It's about two dozen groups that are asking the governor to reform the way that that money is distributed, but also they want some changes in the funding formula for special education to make it more equitable school to school, because they say that the money should go to a school based on what a student actually needs, not just identifying a student with a disability, giving a set amount of money, because, you know, services range in costs.
So how much more do the advocates want the governor to include in his budget for special ed this year?
This year, they're asking for $100 million. So that's about an 8% increase. Last year, they also asked for $100 million. They got $50 million, 4% increase. But really, they say that's still not enough, but they think that it's feasible to get $100 million to fully fund schools for special education costs. They say $465 million is needed.
Mm-hmm. So how are the districts coping if they don't have the resources to make up the gap?
Yeah, so a lot of the advocates I spoke to said they hear concerns from parents every day that my students aid, one-on-one aid that he needs every day is only there 3 days a week. So that can mean that student just isn't going to school 2 days a week or is in seclusion in a school building. It could mean speech therapy hours are down a few hours. And this is illegal. Schools are not allowed to
do
that.
You said illegal.
It's illegal. They have to maintain what the individualized education plan says for that student. But if they don't have the funding, it's just not happening.
And briefly, are there similar conversations happening around the state's basic education allocation, not just special ed?
Sure. Yeah. These advocacy groups say more money is needed no matter what. And it affects all students, but affects students with disabilities.
Sarah Schneider is WESA's education reporter. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. A Census Bureau survey reports that Pittsburgh's population has stabilized overall, but that's despite a decline in the number of African Americans in the city. And we'll hear from a local nonprofit on how they intend to spend a $1 million contract to prevent homelessness in the region. Find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Jordan Miles, an 18-year-old Kappa honors student, is beat by plainclothes City of Pittsburgh police officers in 2010. The white officers claim that Miles, who is black, had a gun. He didn't, and the incident triggered protests and accusations of racial bias within the department. Miles sued in federal court, saying the officers didn't have probable cause to arrest him. After years of litigation, Miles won a $125,000 lawsuit in 2016. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. Allegheny County has awarded $1 million to an East Liberty nonprofit now serving 900 families without a safe and stable place to sleep. Family Links is dedicated to homelessness prevention among families in the county's child welfare system. Joining me in studio is Dr. Mary DiMatteo and Lisa Trunick, Family Links Chief Operating Officer and Program Manager. Mary, Lisa, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Family Links has programs geared towards different barriers to housing, lack of income, mental illness. Tell us about your approach from how you target people and how you target your programming.
Sure. We follow the Housing First model, which was adopted by the Department of Human Services many years ago, which basically we believe housing is a human right for people coming on or people experiencing homelessness. We want to get people stabilized in housing or even stop eviction before it happens.
For our listeners lucky enough to have never experienced this for themselves, tell us how homelessness affects a person and especially a child going through a criminal justice system or civil system.
Sure. Homelessness is a crisis in and of itself. Whenever you lose a stable place to live, that comes with a lot of trauma involved with it. Then you add on top of it, if they're experiencing any other trauma, whether it's mental health, drug and alcohol, criminal justice, if they're involved in those systems, it just compiles all of the trauma.
Family Links offers resources like mental health counseling, substance abuse treatment. Tell us a little bit about the specific population that you're serving.
Family Links serves individuals from birth to seniors in a variety of neighborhoods, income groups, and beliefs across many of our programs. As you said, we have family-centered services in the areas of behavioral health, youth and family services, service coordination, and we also run a senior center in East Liberty that serves the older population.
How important is that sensitivity, understanding of trauma, and how you approach your population?
It's a model where you look at not what is wrong with the individual, but where is the individual at currently, and work with that individual to help build on their resiliencies and their strengths, and taking those into considerations in our treatment approach when working with individuals.
So often homelessness is not the root cause, right? It's not what got someone in the position where they don't necessarily have safe and secure housing. How do you go about addressing the myriad needs that they might have at any given time? What's your first priority?
Our first priority is getting basic needs met, which would be housing, food stability, medical care. We want to get the person into housing, then wrap other services around them. If they need additional support around mental health, if they need support around addiction, we can make referrals out to those services. And then also we have in-house services that we're able to refer to.
How big is the staff that's able to accommodate all this, Mary?
Family Links employs 375 individuals. We have 16 locations across Allegheny County. And in addition, our administrative offices are located in East Liberty. Family Links has 26 programs serving just under 10,000 individuals a year.
I'm Megan Harris. We're in the studio with Mary DiMatteo and Lisa Trunick of Family Links. It recently received a grant for homelessness prevention, an initiative in Allegheny County. So $1 million, ladies. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What will that money go to support?
We are looking to serve 900 families. We're hoping to stop evictions before they happen when someone experiences a trauma, whether that be a loss of a job or if they have outstanding medical bills and they become behind on their rent. We're really looking to support them financially with paying back rent or utilities if that's what's necessary. If they are already in the eviction process, we are also looking at identifying a new unit and hopefully being able to pay either a security deposit or first month's rent.
How do you go about addressing that need? It seems so individual to the person, to the place where they live, and to whatever their need might be at the time, how big their family is even.
Sure. We are planning to meet individually with each family one-on-one within 24 hours of getting that call. We really want to stop the crisis as soon as possible. So we will meet with them and interview them and find out their individual needs and respond accordingly.
How are these folks going to find you? Do you already have your eye on other organizations that you can partner with or other people that might already be kind of in the risk zone for such crises?
This is a CYF grant, Children, Youth, and Family Services. So we will be working closely with the caseworkers to identify the families that are in need of these services. They'll make the referrals, and then we'll be able to assess each individual's needs.
And this is a partnership with CYF. Our Family Link staff will actually be housed in the regional CYF offices so that we can have the greatest impact on the individuals that need our service.
Is that a boon for the organization to have that partnership, not just in, you know, what you're doing every day, but also have that financial backing behind it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Nonprofit organizations struggle financially and times are challenging. So having that partnership and support with CYF is definitely very, very beneficial to the organization.
So when you start those first conversations, how do you address that with the family? What do you look for and how do you counsel them through a process like that?
The CYF workers will identify the family who has possibly just recently lost a job and is running behind on rent, who's just experiencing a little bit of a crisis with past due utilities. They'll identify those clients, make the referral to our organization, and then we will go in and try to work with the landlords to negotiate stopping an eviction before it starts.
Is that something that Family Links has worked on in the past?
Yes, we currently run another CYF housing program called the ARIA program, where we're identifying families who are in need of immediate housing and also working on addiction. So we have landlords in our continuum which work with us currently to house some of these high-risk populations.
And how do the landlords take conversations like this? Are they glad to get the back pay? Are they ever tough or difficult? Or are they really excited to work with an agency that's, you know, working on behalf of someone?
You get a mix. We get landlords who are extremely excited to work with these populations. They see the need in the community. And then you also get the other side of things where there's a lot of stigma around what homelessness means and the people that need the assistance.
Does any of this ever extend into the legal system? You know, could you imagine a place where Family Link steps in or maybe works in court advocacy, that sort of thing?
Absolutely. We, if they are currently in the process of eviction, we are hoping to be able to go to some of these eviction hearings and to the magistrate office to advocate on behalf of the client and also refer for legal services if it's further on in the eviction process and they need more legal assistance.
How often does education come up with all of these conversations? You know, walking your clients through the things that they need to do, so much paperwork, depending on the agency that they're working with.
Yes. A lot of the public is not familiar with their tenant rights. So part of our job is going to be educating the clients on what their rights are, walking through the leases, what's actually in the lease, what they've agreed to and what they need to adhere to, as well as the landlord's responsibilities.
So how do you see this expansion of services then looking in the future? You know, do you hope that it continues beyond what you've received here now with this $1 million grant?
We do really hope that this will be an annual renewal on this grant to continue to help the population that is in need. And just kind of a side note, this program we've entitled NOVA. So it'll be the name of this new program for folks when you hear that. That's the new homeless program.
NOVA with Family Links?
Yes.
Yes.
How can folks get in touch?
You can call our main number, or if you're involved with the CYF system and need a referral, you should speak to your CYF caseworker about the referral.
Mary?
Family Link's main number to access any of our services is 866-583-6003.
And last question, ladies, as you look in the future, how do you hope that this maybe changes the face of homelessness in Allegheny County, you know, 1, 2, 5 years down the road?
We're really hoping that we can stop homelessness before it starts. That's our biggest goal, and take a lot of pressure off of the homeless system. We want to stop the crisis before it happens and keep people out of the shelters, keep people off of the street, stop trauma before families have to be split from homelessness.
Mary DiMatteo and Lisa Trunick are the Chief Operating Officer and Program Manager at Family Links. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Megan.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The city of Pittsburgh has been losing population for decades, but for now, at least, it's down to a trickle. A recent Census Bureau survey estimates that when the new census is taken later this year, the city will likely remain stable at about 303,000. I spoke recently with Mayor Bill Peduto in his office about why Pittsburghers are still leaving town or dying as quickly as newcomers arrive.
Oh, if I knew that answer, I would do a lot more to try to reverse it. We are facing several different issues. Number one, we still have an older population, and there are still more people who are passing on than that are being born in the city. So we start out with a negative. The opportunity to be able to see a flat population growth within the city actually means more people are moving in than moving out when you take into consideration that more people are dying than being born. However, even given that, we still have a missing generation, people my age, people that were born in the 1960s and the early part of the 70s, left and never came back. And what we'll see because of that is a bubble effect where the city will go from very old to very young very quickly. Once we have that, there's a couple critical things. Number one is, in order to create options for people to move into the city, we'll need to create more housing. And we'll have to do that in such a way that the housing market that's being built is never at 100% capacity. Otherwise, we'll see a spike in rental fees. And the second part is, we still are living off of the legacy of the collapse of the steel industry, and we have blight throughout so many of our neighborhoods. The opportunity to create housing opportunities, the opportunity for people to actually get into home ownership is very real and very possible here. And by doing so, we'll also be able to keep housing affordable. So it's two tracks. It's being proactive on the affordability side and turning blight into opportunity. And it's continuing to build on the market side so that it's not a competition for every single apartment by who can pay the most, but where the developers themselves are in competition to offer lower rents.
That same Census Bureau survey found the city has lost nearly 7,000 African-American residents. Why are our black residents, why are our black neighbors leaving the city of Pittsburgh?
Well, this isn't a new trend. This is something that we have seen since the 1980s. It has been something that has happened in not only our historically black neighborhoods, but white neighborhoods as well. In fact, if you go back from 2000 to 2010, the lack of investment in places like East Liberty, in Homewood, in Larimer, in the North Side, in the West End, in the Hilltop communities, we saw a drastic reduction in the number of black families living in the city. So when I was on city council representing an area around the universities, my district actually grew 10% from 2000 to 2010, while Reverend Burgess's district across the street lost 23% of its population.
Your district being more white, and Reverend Burgess's district having a higher percentage of African Americans.
And this being during a time when East Liberty was not being developed, when the disinvestment, which is what was forcing people out of those neighborhoods. What we've seen over these past 10 years is a lot of people leaving low-income neighborhoods in order to be able to raise their children in suburban areas because of schools. We see people leaving because of taxes or because of crime. Part of it, yes, is gentrification, but it's simple and wrong to paint with one brush and ask why people are leaving when we have decades of history that shows us many different answers to that question.
Carl Redwood of the Hill District Consensus Group told the Confluence he's not surprised by that decrease in the number of African-American residents of the city. You've said in the past to me, quote, there's a very strong connection between being black in Pittsburgh and inequity. So what are you doing to reduce that inequity? What can you do?
Well, there's a number of different areas that we already have data that show where disparity exists. It's not a question. Part of it is through the access to adequate housing. So we created a housing trust fund in order to be able to provide opportunities for everyone to have housing that is available that is also at a better standard than what we have offered in the past. We have looked at opportunities for children when they're not in school. On weekends and during the summer, in the summer of Earn and Learn. We've took away the fees for swimming during the summers in order to be able to give kids healthy alternatives. We've created food programs, the first in the city, that make sure that our children are being fed. And we've offered libraries to every child in the city so that by the time they're five, they have a library of 60 books. We're working with the county executive in order to create pre-K opportunities. And we also realize there's great disparity when it comes to access to health care. And not just physical health, but mental health care. And we have partnered with a number of different nonprofits in order to be able to increase the access to health care while our federal and state government continues to take it away. We recognize and we can quantify where disparity is real based upon race, and we have created programs around those areas of housing, education, children, and health to be able to make that disparity less.
Access to health care, access to affordable housing, but what about access to family-sustaining jobs? How do you address that, though?
It's a challenge, especially in an economy that continues to change towards knowledge. And when you're not given the basics of a foundation, the chances of you having secondary education or graduating with the necessary skills are minimal, which then limits your ability to have access to quality jobs. So we have to be able to train people specifically for programs where we know we're going to need workers. We need to concentrate more upon the healthcare industry and training kids beginning in seventh grade, training them for finance and banking jobs, being able to understand that not everybody needs a four-year college degree, but many times a two-year associate can put somebody at the age of 20 in a position where they can have a career and not a job. We're doing it in the city of Pittsburgh with public safety and creating an academy for public safety at Westinghouse High School to train the next generation of police officers, firefighters, and medics. But we need to do it across sector, and that really requires a cooperation and a partnership with our corporate community. Having them identify where those jobs are going to be needed in the next 10 years, we can start right now in middle school to get ready to have those young people not only have an opportunity for a career, but stay here and rebuild the population.
Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Residents who live near the Clairton Coke Works and who sued U.S. Steel over emissions and odors have until next Monday, January 20th, to decide if they want to be part of a settlement reached with the company. WESA's Reed Frazier has been following the suit, joins us now. Reed, we've heard about lawsuits before. What is this suit in connection to?
Okay, well, maybe it'd be best to say what it's not.
Okay.
So if you remember last year, December 24th, 2018, there was a big fire that put out the plant's pollution controls for several months. This lawsuit is related to pollution that occurred before that fire. So it's several years where the plant was still violating Allegheny County Health Department regulations, but it's for the nuisance that the plant created before that fire.
So what are the residents' concerns? What have they told you?
Well, the lawsuit itself is saying that the plant's pollution interfered with the comfort of their lives, of the class of plaintiffs mm-hmm. that brought it. They couldn't close their doors or windows. They had to stay inside because of the smell. They had to constantly clean their house because of the soot that deposited. So it's sort of a broad, can't use my home the way I wanted it to complaint. I mean, I've talked to people who've had pretty serious health concerns, cancer, heart problems that they say are related to the plant, but that's a little bit of a different animal than this lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. Have health officials, environmentalists weighed in on this settlement?
I mean, generally the sense from environmental groups is that, this plant is a perpetual polluter. There are a number of other legal actions that are being taken, not just by environmental groups, but also by the regulator, the county health department, to sort of, fight what they perceive as persistent pollution from this particular facility.
The settlement was approved by a judge in December. It allocates $6.5 million to repairs and another $2 million to be split by plaintiffs. Assuming the residents choose to opt in, how much are they going to receive?
Well, I talked to one gentleman who was at a meeting to answer legal questions, and he said that the amount that he was told, and other people have said this, is $190 a household for the 5,600-some households that are inside the geographical area of this lawsuit. So it's a little bit under $200, maybe.
Doesn't sound too much for somebody who might have suffered some health concerns.
Yeah, well, actually, this lawsuit doesn't include, like, even if you opt into this lawsuit, you can still sue for legal damages that you can prove are related to the pollution from the Clairton plant.
So they have until next Monday again to decide whether they want to be part of the settlement. If they don't, they can sue. But what happens if a lot of people say no?
U.S. Steel can cancel the lawsuit essentially if 20 people decide to opt out.
Okay. And have you spoken to anyone that said they're not going to agree to it?
I haven't. Let me backtrack. Yes, I think I've talked to somebody who was leaning that way. He just said, right. I've been living with this pollution all my life. I'm not going to just sign away my rights to sue for $190.
Reed Frazier is a reporter for Allegheny Front and State Impact Pennsylvania. Thanks so much, Reed.
Thank you, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time on The Confluence, it was 10 years ago that the false arrest of an 18-year-old African-American honors student and his beating by three white police officers enraged the black community. In the decades since, have relations improved? We'll talk with David Harris about his new book, A City Divided. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistants from Caldwell Holden and Caroline Burke. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.